You're saying you weren't recording that? The lost episode. Listener, they'll never know. They'll never know what we were talking about.
Never.
It was good, though. Shameful.
We welcome back, everyone.
Welcome. Wait, was there supposed to be music?
Oh, Jesus. Why? They really won't know. All right, let's try this again.
No, you keep this part in. You keep this part in.
Yep, it's staying, I guess. Especially if Alex is doing the edit.
You said you were doing it.
I said I could.
Oh, okay.
Do you guys think this makes for, like, good audio? Like, people listening?
No.
Do they like this?
God, no.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Talking Smack, where we talk superheroes, movies, animation, comics, and we also talk over our intro music because we are professionals like that.
Is this why we haven't hit it big yet?
it's possible.
We are doing great on YouTube. We are, like, since the beginning of the year, we have, like, tripled our audience. It's fantastic.
That's great.
All right. I'm your host, Josh Scar, and joining me as always is Alex, and joining us as semi-regularly is Matt. Matt, hey, guys, how you doing?
Doing good. How about you?
Alex, I'll let you answer first.
I thought it was going to be kind of like
I'm just watching my Eero right now. Eero, not a sponsor, but should be. I use it all the time.
Not for this one.
Not right now.
Hey, I upgraded last year from a T-Mobile branded Asus router that was about 8 years old to an Aero Mesh, and it's fantastic.
We're naming a lot of like brand names that do not pay us to talk about them.
I'm using my Volcaster right now. I got my D-Link
Focusrite Volcaster. Yep. On my Audio Technica mic, MT or 2010, whatever that is, AT 2010.
I upgraded to a new Logitech G520 mouse after my one that was 14 years old finally gave out after like 14 million clicks in Destiny. But I will say that my Logitech Modern Warfare 2, 1, the original, not the remake, so like 15 years out, my G105 is still going strong, baby. That WASD is rocking it.
My microphone is brand redacted. Plugged into my redacted.
Isn't it the Yeti mic that
laptop.
I gave you that we started the podcast with?
Is it? I don't know.
I know if it's the Yeti mic that I gave you, yeah, that's the mic we started the podcast with, and it's still going strong.
I redacted it. They didn't pay me, so.
Matt, you sound really nice through my Sony MDR7506 professional headphones.
Is that a Stanley Cup, Mac?
It is a similar kind of cup from brand redacted.
Oh, perhaps it's an Arctic,
but it is not
cup like mine.
It is not either of those brands. Listen,
this entire segment not brought to you by anyone except our own little.
Let me just say this: this is why you guys are the stars.
Hey, I wish right now, I really wish that this was a video medium, because Josh and I were very much doing the Wayne's World 2, like, sponsorship.
I will bow to no sponsor.
Yeah, that sounded, that's editing magic for you. That sounded like it took about 4 interminable minutes. Actually, it was actually about 20 to 25 as they did their costume changes and did the setups for shots and stuff.
That's being generous too, because, you know, I got to make sure the crotch fits just right with those Reebok pants.
Well, you know, the thing about it is, while I'm sitting here wearing my MeUndies, unlike Spider-Man's outfit, they don't ride a little high in the crotch. They fit just right and they cup.
Well played.
And gently hold.
Nice Spider-Man 2 reference. Spider-Man 2 back in theaters. Thanks, Sony. Not a sponsor.
Not anymore.
Hey, I gotta get like
not
two
after
more
we
of these.
Bashed Madam Web.
No, it was only for like it was only in theaters for like 4 days.
It's true.
And not near
and
me.
We saw it.
I'm talking about Spider-Man 2, Josh.
Oh, Spider-Man 2. Madam Web was out of theaters about as quickly.
I wonder if they didn't even change the signage. They just like put in Spider-Man 2 and hoped people kept showing up. Like, it's a web movie. It's a web movie. They'll show up. They'll show up.
Well, those poor projectionists, you know what podcast they should listen to? The Fuck My Work Life podcast, which they have now recently updated to the Fuck My Whole Life podcast. But We haven't updated the promo yet, so we're going to go with the one that we have. So here's J&K from the Fuck My Whole Life podcast, and we'll be right back.
Work sucks. Am I right, Jay?
Yeah, Kay, it does. But luckily, the Fuck My Work Life podcast is here to help you through.
In this comedy podcast, we share memorable workplace stories through guests and listener submissions in the hopes of brightening your day, or at least leave you thinking, maybe you don't have it so bad after all.
Listen to Fuck My Work Life on your favorite podcast platform and follow us on all the socials at FMWLpod.
Hey, Josh, I just got an update from them over there at the Fuck My Life Whole Life podcast that I actually like to update one more time to Fuck You and Your Life and Mine and Everything in This World podcast.
They must have watched the Fallout series.
Since I'm very good for SEO.
It's okay. We've got Alex's wife on the job for SEO. She'll optimize all of our search engines.
Can I ask a question? And maybe we can cut this out. It says there's one person in the audience. Is somebody just like listening in on us right now?
I don't even see an audience. Like there shouldn't be.
Three here, one in the audience.
Yeah.
Is that people?
In the top, yeah.
You know what? That's probably the FBI agent who is assigned to us.
Yeah, that's strange. Hey. I don't know. There isn't a chat. All participants, 4. Yeah, maybe it's thinking I'm still here with my previous attempt at. I'm guessing that's probably what it is. If not, hi, whoever is watching this.
Yeah, we can cut that out. That's
even funnier.
It's been staring at me for a few minutes. So,
well, we must not be entertaining. Matt's studying who's in the audience. He's looking up for.
What is it that Tommy Lee Jones told Jim Carrey when they were filming Batman Forever? I cannot sanction your buffoonery.
Yeah, I know that quote because I think it every time I'm on this show. Yeah, I think about that every time I'm on this show.
God damn it.
Buffoonery is what gets the clicks, or being outright racist incel, and I don't want to do that.
There's I can't even finish. I was going to start fucking around saying there's a time and a place for that, but there isn't.
There's not. Let's just move on. We are doing a What You Doing episode where we just talk about the things we're doing away from the podcast. This is also going to be a pseudo follow-up episode to our Fallout episode because Alex finished the series. Applause.
Yay.
Golf clap. Yay. So we're going to start with that, I think, and kind of go into spoiler thoughts and opinions. It's been out for about 2 weeks now, and apparently it's doing gangbusters for Amazon, as well as it has officially been renewed for season 2, which I believe we discussed in the review episode. But just to reiterate, so Alex, lead us into your thoughts on Fallout.
So one of the things I would like to apologize for is
it making me defend it? Incest?
No, I will never do that. So I don't get to edit this week because I did that. It's like, can I just swap this around enough to make it seem like Josh defended incest? But I don't know how the hell I miss it. But in episode 4, when Lucy has one of her turning points and comes back up to the ghoul after the stuff that happened in the supermarket drugstore, she actually dropped her F-bomb for the series. I don't know how I completely missed that. I think I may have been shocked by it. Maybe I was taking a sip of water. Maybe I know part of me was going in my head during that part, like, okay, he's got to be smart. He's got to go back inside. There's a treasure trove of crap stuff. Maybe I was thinking too critically, but yeah, because I went back to the episode and yeah, she just straight up says golden rule, motherfucker.
And that's an interesting moment too, because we were talking about, I think that was as far as he had gotten when we watched it. Well, that's actually a moment that was maybe slightly incongruous to me, because like that is a thing that is not necessarily the swear itself, but that whole thing is constructed as like, oh, this is her turning point where she is like become hardened to some degree toward this life up here. And then they sort of pull back from that in a weird way where like I think the next episode is where she meets up with Titus again. And he's stuck in the armor and she's like, oh, well, gee willikers or whatever, which is great and cute. But I was like, oh, it wasn't like an episode ago. She was oh, I'm the badass now who swears and has to kill zombie grannies and stuff. Anyway, you were still going into your thoughts.
Yeah, so I finished the back half. And speaking of that scene, because that scene is pretty close to the fifth episode, which is called The Past, that fucking Maximus makes a dumbass decision to tell Thaddeus who he actually really is, enabling the suit to get disabled, and he's stuck in it. And this is a part where I do feel like, for being a barren wasteland, and I know the population sizes are supposed to be smaller, but man, there's a whole lot of, I just happen to run into you again, the three people I know here. But pairing them together really does work, especially as they visit Shady Sands and they continue the exploration of the world building. I really prefer this style of flashbacks as we go and explore the ghoul's past a bit more over, say, something like the Resident Evil TV series or The Witcher season one with its weird time framing. That this seemed to be more, it seemed to be very organic in why they were flashing back. Yes, it is a kind of like tropey thing of like, oh, he has a memory and all of a sudden, boosh, back in time. But I think by playing into the ghoul needing to have his disease satiated slowed through the medicines, and then being somewhere where TV is on, it made a lot of sense that this is a point and purpose of a backflash episode.
Sure, there's like a specific,
is like explore more
like
of what happened
on which he is like remembering that time in his life, right?
Mm-hmm. So to speak of something that's a little bit in, you said incruitous or
incongruous.
Lucy and Maximus end up in Vault 4, I think it is.
I think it's 4, yeah.
Which I love. Yeah, I love that you start getting that the vaults are a little bit different and what they were doing, why they were there, their purpose and intention of each vault. And you get the legacy of Moldover being the Flame Mother, and apparently people from the surface who were taken in by this vault are still worshiping her. This is where I find it a little odd. So she has one of the best gags, or rather Maximus does, in that Lucy's bored with Maximus as they're waiting for like decontamination or whatever, and she offers to have sex with him. And he's like, and he's afraid to, because he's heard that if you try to have sex, it pops. Like a
pimple. He like describes the thing that happens when someone with a penis engages in sexual intercourse in like the grossest, like most literal but also disgusting way like possible.
Whoever wrote that, bless you.
It's great world building too, because like it tells you everything you need to know about the Brotherhood and how they try to keep their people from engaging in recreational sex, as well as it tells you how the Vault Dwellers view sex. Is it is literally recreational, like, oh, I'm bored, you want to bang, like, okay,
right? Which also matches up with first episode with her wedding, where her husband she just met strips down and she just goes, okay, well, that's dude, and she's aggressive about it, like, yeah, we're doing
and this. That's a thing too, where I think one of the things the show is doing is like all the characters to varying degrees, but especially Lucy and Titus, are like very naive in different ways. And that is like in this, I think it's the second episode where all the stuff with his knight happens, where he dies and stuff, where I was like, man, you're like turning on this guy really quickly. But as like the show went on, as around this time in the series where like we're getting to the vault, I'm like, oh, like he's just like exceptionally naive, where like this guy is telling him, oh, you didn't do exactly what I said, so they're going to string you up. And he's immediately like, oh, God. Like, he just has so little frame of reference for the world around him in a way that is, like, similar to but different than the way Lucy does, that I thought was really interesting. And then with the ghoul, it's mostly in his, like, flashback where, like, in life, he was sort of naive to what was happening at Vault-Tec and things like that. So that was a really interesting parallel I noticed around that point in the series.
They do a great job of what you don't know is what you don't know. and how that shapes you, which I really, really appreciate that. Because as disenfranchised as the ghoul is now over 200 years of whatever misery they've been putting him through, where he ends up buried and like harvested in some way a few times, you know, and then dug up and all that stuff, he seemed to have every intention of being a good husband and trying to support his wife. Because even when they show him having some disagreements with his wife, it's never in front of the kid. And it's never like because it is doing the retrofuturism thing. So you could, I'm not saying forgive it, but you could understand if they're like, well, he's going to be like, woman, you know, how dare you? You should be home more often and, you know, crap. And I'm the breadwinner. You know, he doesn't do that. He respects her work and what she's doing. He's just frustrated by the hours and the people that she's surrounding him with, not who she surrounds herself with, but who he's forced to interact with.
Yeah, and then things get weirder and weirder around Vol-Tec and her being sort of like bought in on it.
Since we were talking about like the experiments within the vaults and the ghoul's wife, I will say the one thing that I walked away from the show where I'm just like, that was dumb, I didn't like that, it was the motivation for the vault experiments, because it's literally just decided what the vaults are going to be doing in a boardroom meeting. Yeah. And they literally just laid out like, oh, we're going to breed mutants in this one, like whatever radiation imbued freaks, this one will get to have people come in and they'll just breed a whole race of mutants for whatever reason. And this one, we're just going to overpopulate it and see who survives. And this one, we're going to starve them. And it felt a little too twirly mustache, where they're just like, everything that is going wrong with these is because of us. Whereas I feel like it should have been more, this manager is in charge of this vault, this person's in charge of this vault, or so many vaults, and they get bored. And then they're like, I'm going to fuck with this thing. And yeah. I think that makes more sense in a real world application, where I get they're trying to just make the corporation the bad guy.
Well, that's true. But I think, and you know, we talked about this in the episode, I think, What is happening there in the show is more in line with the games, because I don't think that is the case for the games, right? I think it is a thing where Vol-Tec set up these various things that were, among other things, intended as these social experiments to greater and lesser degrees. So there is a sense, like there's a vault where the thing is every year they have to choose somebody who they sacrifice, or the story goes, everybody in the vault will die, right? It's like, it's not just necessarily, it's just like a thing Vol-Tec came up with as a mustache twirly corporate villain, as opposed to things just got weird because everyone was locked up. You know what I mean?
I did particularly enjoy that as the revelations started coming out that about Vault 31, that it really seemed to track. They laid the groundwork very well with Lucy's brother back there going, things are just off, and why are things off? And they gave him enough agency, but also enough, I guess, bravery that he was going to pursue this, even though he seemed to know that Betty was onto him once she's elected overseer. But then his friend, whose name I forget.
Wasn't that their cousin?
Yeah. He
wasn't it like Teddy or something?
Yeah.
It's something pretty generic.
He basically, once he gets assigned his new wife, basically, since she basically moves in and tells him, like, so you're going to replace my husband and raise his baby, he just rolls over and gives in. And I liked that. I liked that. I like that he was basically just, I'm going to go along with this. I am going through with this. I didn't get picked by Lucy. I got picked by her. I will take care of this kid. And, you know, you're kind of on your own. I'm a coward. And he just straight up says that, which I actually really liked. But then they also were doing the groundwork with just how nefarious Betty wants to be now that she's overseer, by setting it up that someone is going to take the fall for all the Raiders dying. Even though she she was telling them, you know, we're going to take care of them. This is who we are, you know, and she was kind of snooping around, making sure that everything's going well, and has this kind of interesting conversation with Norm about, like, you can't do anything yet. I know you're planning something. I know you're thinking about stuff. And then, yeah, she basically is the one who made sure they're all taken care of before she enacts her new plans. And that is just straight up sadistic and creepy. And I'm really excited to see where that stuff starts to shake out in season two, because everything happening in the vault seems to have as much purpose and as many ramifications as what's happening up topside. It doesn't yet seem like one of those situations where, oh, we're flashing back to the vault again. You know, the real story's up top. What's going on? Oh, we have to do the B plot. No, the B plot is engaging. The B plot with Norm and everything that's happening as you start to realize, as he begins his agency of realizing that Vault-Tec is just straight up not the promised thing.
Yeah, it's really slick about, they really bring all that stuff together in the end, because, you know, I think you could be forgiven as, for a lot of that show, maybe seeing the vault stuff as maybe superfluous. Not that it's bad. It's just like, I don't know where this is going. And if you know the games, you expect it to be like, oh, they're going to find out the thing from the games, which is that all the vaults are these weird experiments. And I know that, so I have a sense that that's where this is going. But then what they do is they tie it to the broader story, right? They even tie it to the flashbacks with the ghoul, with Cooper, in a really slick way, where it's like, oh, this is where all the people who are trying to write out the apocalypse went. This was the vault where they all, instead of an experiment, they all froze themselves in a way that I thought was really, maybe, you know, I think if one wanted to say it was maybe too neat, where everything was too connected, I would understand that, but it really worked for me. I thought it was really worked really well.
Yeah. And I mean, if you want to talk about like superfluous storytelling and just like trying to Game of Thrones, a tapestry of a storyline, like I think the Halo series is probably the best example I could come up with, because people care about like Master Chief, and maybe they care about like Captain Keyes and Dr. Halsey. But the Halo series decided, like, oh, we're going to have this like ex-Spartan storyline where he was Chief's best friend in boot camp, but he defected and ran away and he got married and had a kid. Soren, that's his name. And it's just like the most boring melodramatic storyline that does not connect to anything in the show until like they're like, oh, we're getting canceled unless we do this thing to like combine everything. And they use his storyline to kick off the Flood outbreak on just like in the galaxy, and it's still stupid, it's boring, and it makes no sense whatsoever. They could have done any number of different things to make that show interesting, and they're like, let's Game of Thrones this and introduce new characters that are boring and uninteresting.
Halo, and I've only seen like half the first season of Halo, which is not like necessarily even anything about it, like both is and is not a reflection on its quality, because I did not stop watching it because I didn't like it. I missed a week, and then the next thing I knew, the entire season was over, and I was like, oh well, I guess the fact that I totally forgot this show was happening is kind of an indication in of itself where I was at with it.
Season two kicked off really strong, and then they just completely bypassed the Fall of Reach, which it felt like that's what they were building towards. They're like, okay, we're gonna episode two will end with like the lead into the Fall of Reach, three will be the kickoff, four onward will be the Fall of Reach, and then maybe by the end of it we'll have like the end of Halo Reach, where like Chief goes off and they find the ring. No, they do the Fall of Reach within a 40 minute episode, and then they do like three more episodes where it's just Chief recovering from the Fall of Reach and deciding what to do, and then the final like two or three episodes after that are building up towards Chief finally getting on the ring and also the Flood coming. And it's such a slow, uninteresting burn. Whoever is running that show, clearly was like, well, we need to make it our own. We don't want to make it predictable. Master Chief is a nothing character, which, like, fine. Master Chief taking off the helmet and all that, like, fine, do that. But make it interesting. And there's so little that is interesting in that show.
Halo is, and we're kind of off topic here, but it's a really interesting.
It's what you're doing. There is no.
That's true. It's a really interesting example of, like, a thing you see a lot in TV now. And, like, people on the internet will call this the, it's from a tweet, we'll call this the Surf Dracula problem, where, to paraphrase the tweet, in the 90s, if there was a show called Surf Dracula, he'd be on his surfboard every week. But in a show now that would be called Surf Dracula, they'd make you wait 10 episodes before he sees a surfboard and thinks about surfing, you know, where there's this thing that, for whatever reason, shows, especially this kind of thing, really makes you wait. I think they feel like there has to be some moment of arrival for, like, it to become the thing. Behind the curtain a little bit, we were talking a little bit offline today, off mic rather. About, like, the various Disney Plus Marvel shows, right? And that is all over those shows, where so many of these shows, there is a moment at the end of the series in episode 6 where they step up and this is the moment they become.
And now they're Hawkeye. Now they're
Ms. Marvel, now they're Moon Knight. Even in shows where they're, like, wearing the costume the whole time, right? Like, Moon Knight is one where the moment is, oh, these two personalities are finally working together, so now they can be the Moon Knight they were always meant to be or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's just this sense that, like, no matter where they are in the journey, they don't become the thing until the end. And that's just a weird thing that happens with TV these days of a certain ilk. And Fallout, to get back on topic.
Yeah, weirdly, I was just about to say Fallout. Yeah. Fallout does the thing that, like I said, when we did the episode review, it's the thing. It does the thing that I want these video game adaptations to do. It does what The Last of Us does, where it just plops you into the world and it's like, here's your story. Where so many, like, bad video game adaptations for a long time had to, like, they decided, well, it's more interesting if we establish the rules of the world instead of just going into it and expositing when you need to. If you need to, like, you can do a show, don't tell. Or you can have that naive character that's never been outside the walls of the city or whatever, and they need to have the stuff explained to them. You can do it in an interesting way that's not just like, oh, this person is from the real world, and now they're thrown into the video game world, and we have to explain the rules to them.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think Halo and Fallout are both sort of similar in terms of adaptation. Insofar as, like,
creating an original story,
sort of, but they're both based on things that don't really have, like, a central character. Like, Master Chief is a character, but he's also not, like, he's just a generic soldier guy, although sometimes in certain games they gesture at other deeper personality. But so if you're going to make a show about Halo and base it on those characters, you know, I don't envy you having to figure out how that works. But then with Fallout, it's a similar situation where, you know, these games are not based on a specific character, an authored character. You make your own character, and then most of the time, the only thing that they say is, like, the text dialogue that you choose, and then they don't speak it.
Yeah, they're a literal avatar for you playing the game.
Yeah, so, like, it's interesting. Maybe it's just that the world lends itself to a more original story with Fallout, because you can set it wherever. There's things you can pull from, but it's more built to tell a story with a brand new character, as opposed to Halo, which is so associated with Master Chief, who is, like, frustratingly not a character. So then you have to, you know, it's a tough nut to crack, and I'm not surprised that they didn't quite crack it for a number of reasons, not least of which that it was some form of Halo adaptation was in development hell for, like, 20 years or something before they finally
Peter Jackson was tied to it for the longest time, and then District 9 guy, and it is somewhat miraculous that they even got two seasons out of it, let alone not, like, moving on from trying to do a movie.
I would really like to see the original scripts, because a famous story that I heard is that when Microsoft decided they wanted to do the Halo series, they had a group of employees probably from Bungie, go dress up like Master Chief and deliver like the movie script, like a trilogy movie script, to one of the studios being like, yeah, we've done all the work, just give us the money. I would love to read those scripts because I really want to know like what fever dream of a show or a trilogy or whatever that they came up with that Hollywood was like, nah, we're good.
I mean, in the, those pre-2010 Halo ads when Bungie was still in charge of it before the end of with Halo Reach, those ads were all like mini war movies. Like they were proof of concept in a way where they're like, look what we can do. Just give us the bigger budget and we can do this. And they were just like, no, just keep making those ads, man. People love them.
Well, that's also a weird time where like, I think Halo might sort of predate this as like a trend, but also sort of inspired the trend where there was a time, especially in the 2010s, where if you had a narrative video game series that had like even the barest wisp of a story, it was not just that you had a video game series, you had a multimedia like strategy built into the concept from day one, where like, oh, we have novels that are coming out that explore these characters between things. We have, you know, comics, we have whatever else. Like Mass Effect did that. Gears of War did that. Like fucking Gears of War, Assassin's Creed, all kinds of stuff. And like, you know, Halo was in there too, but I think it was more like Halo was really big. Oh, let's write some novels that explore this world. And then everyone was like, oh, people want to buy these novels. And then suddenly it's like, oh, well, I mean, you gotta figure out what Saren's deal is and write a novel about it so people will buy it when they pick up Mass Effect. So like in a way there is this weirdly fleshed out world that you could, I guess somebody at Bungie is like coordinating with writers to, maybe they could have made a movie, I don't know.
Yeah, there's that concept of building within worlds is fascinating because I think the Blair Witch Project, I think this is 25th year anniversary or something like that, and they're talking about rebooting that, and I was looking into it. There's like three or four books that came out after the movie came out. I know there was a few video games, and there was the one from like 2018 that Blooper did or whatever that I own that was good. But I remember walking through a library once, and there was a little section of like 15 X-Files books, and they're not based off episodes. They're just additional stories. And yeah, and that's the same kind of thing that Hollywood seems to love, that they also seemed really tentative about, because Bungie, part of the reason why they sold themselves to Disney had been that as they were preparing, they had hired like somebody to finally become like the lore keeper of, because if you play Destiny, every gun, every piece of ammo, there's lore written into each, like, you know, half a page or so. You get little triumphs of completing weekly missions. You get like a 2-page little novel to read that fills out over the season as you do things. You little triumphs like, oh yeah, you discovered all the chests on this planet. Here's 6 pages of backstory. And part of the reason they wanted it sold is they wanted the connection with Disney Pictures, Sony Pictures, to like get a TV show or something going. And that seems to have fallen by the wayside over the last year and a half, because I haven't heard anything about that. But I would love a Destiny show. They have a few books about their lore that they've released themselves.
Well, I mean, this all, and it all ultimately probably traces back to Star Wars, right? Where in that interim between Return
Lucas
of the Jedi,
didn't know if he would ever get approved for a sequel. He didn't know what the budget would be. There's the pretty infamous, I forget the name of the novel now, but I know Mr. Sunday Movies did a video on it. But there was a book that he commissioned to be written that could also be adapted. And it was really low budget, where like Han Solo is just completely written out of the story. Like he just has to go do a thing. And it's just a Leia and Luke adventure in like a jungle somewhere. And Vader's just hunting them down. And so it would be really low budget, and they would get rid of the most expensive cast member in Harrison Ford. And it would just be basically a 2-on-1 Predator style movie. That's just not quite as visceral and with a weird, potentially incestuous relationship happening.
Yeah. And I mean, like in between, even beyond that, once that trilogy ends, a little while later, people are like, "Ooh, we should like write about their continuing adventures." And then Lucas is like, "Yeah, whatever. I don't give a shit," you know. And then you know, you saw that with Star Trek too. Like those side story books. You were talking about X-Files. There's tons of those for Star Trek that are just like, some of them are adaptations of episodes, but a lot of them are also like, oh, here's something that happened on Deep Space Nine between like when you weren't looking or whatever. You know, those become big business where like there's an entire, there's for both of those franchises, there's an entire expanded universe of additional stories that people get very attached to and get upset when they are stricken from canon. And I think the difference becomes in the 2010s, video games are like, ooh, we can do that, but we can like make it part of our marketing from the start as opposed to something that just arises organically out of a fandom. So it's like you go out, Gears of War 2 comes out, and that same day there's already four novels on the stands with, oh, this random character you saw actually had a whole adventure of his own. You can read about it in
Gears of War. It's like Luigi and Mario and the Thousand Year Door.
Yeah.
Well, to tie it back to Dungeons and Dragons, as I want to do.
As you were wont to do.
Dungeons and Dragons have been doing that since they came out. There's hundreds of Dungeons and Dragons novels. A lot of them really, really bad in the 80s, but some of them are just fantastic. You have the Dritz novels, which seem to be the thing that that Hasbro pays its most attention to nowadays. But even their rival Pathfinder, they have a bunch of Pathfinder novels that are just really damn good based around the stories and lore of the world. So that, you know, if you're flipping through the Dungeon Master Guide or a Monster Manual or something, you see a piece of artwork you like, and Pathfinder is famous for their iconics, basically the main archetype for each of their class. They have a very specific character background, story, and lore within. They have novels about them too. That's something I love about Pathfinder, is that it's not they've done a really good job of taking the idea of this is a homogenous world that we have a continuity and a line and heroes that you play in, versus what I think Hasbro is trying to do now with Dungeons and Dragons, which is kind of shape 50 years of nothingness into something by discarding everything they don't agree with anymore. And so I find that really fascinating.
Hasbro's in such a weird and bad run. I got to find the tweet here. I know I wanted to talk about Kyle Higgins and the Massiveverse stuff that he announced, but now that you're on Hasbro here real quick. Hasbro recently licensed out the Power Rangers IP. They're no longer going to make their Power Rangers toy line. They licensed it out to Toku Playmates Toys, which is a rival of theirs. But because the Power Rangers line is losing money for them in terms of action figures and whatnot, they're just like, fuck it, we'll make more money licensing this out. Apparently they needed to make $50 million in revenue with 10% OP, which I don't know these business terms, and it could grow up to $100 million or 15% OP over the year over year. And that didn't happen for them over the last like 2 or 3 years that they've had the line. And Kyle Higgins, who famously wrote the first 32 issues of the Boom Studios Power Rangers run, I think he kind of let a little bit more out of the bag than he was intending, maybe, or maybe he just doesn't care anymore. But this is 1000% me speculating. But I think around the time he left the series is when Hasbro took over from Saban Brands. And he was just like, Hasbro has no idea what they have, and they're just completely shitting the bed with this. It's sort of like when Disney bought Power Rangers. Like, for some reason, Saban Brands is the only company that knows how to properly market and produce Power Rangers stuff. Because when Disney had it for, I think, like 5 years, and they just completely tanked the market for Power Rangers. And then they sold it back to Saban Brands for like pennies on the dollar.
Well, that intersects with a couple of things that, Disney owns Star Wars now. And without getting into like any deeper questions of like how they're handling it, one of the things they did almost immediately with the video game side of it was they signed Electronic Arts to an exclusive deal to make Star Wars games that like only just recently expired. But for a long time, they only produced like two games, and it was the two Battlefront games that nobody really, people hated. And it wasn't, and it was only recently in the last few years that they put out those, the Jedi games, the Jedi Survivor and Jedi Outcast that people like more. But it's a, that's a situation where it's like, okay, you have like this massive franchise that you bought that traditionally has like pretty solid video games. And for the most part, the one company that you license it out to is not doing anything with it.
Yeah, it's really bizarre because like the thing that's frustrated me so much is I love the Muppets, and Disney bought Jim Henson Studios like late 90s after he passed away and didn't do anything with it until Jason Segel said, hey, I have an idea. And I love his movie. I love that Muppets movie. But then he was busy with How I Met Your Mother and working on another project. They did Muppets Most Wanted, which didn't do as well. Then they said, do a variety show, or, you know, like, but make it a reality show. Yeah, do The Office. And then, and that, and we do kind of have a decent run where they're kind of doing one-offs, like, you know, the Muppets Haunted Mansion, which is kind of cute, mm-hmm. and some stuff, but
they're doing parodies. They're not doing original Muppet stories, which like the Muppets in and of themselves are parodies of celebrities. So like, you need to use that as the novelty. You don't need to just, I mean, I'm kind of shooting myself in the foot with this argument because A Muppet Christmas Carol exists, but that movie only works because Michael Caine came in and said, I'm playing this 100% straight. This mm-hmm. doesn't work unless I am acting as if this is normal.
Right.
And that's where I think Brian Henson was the one who directed A Muppet Christmas Carol. And he was like, no, that's brilliant. That makes perfect sense. Like, they hadn't even considered it until Michael Caine is like, this is what needs to happen.
Right, which is the exact kind of like opposite, the joke of the reason why Muppet Treasure Island worked is because in that movie, Tim Curry's the Muppet. Yes. And everyone around him is serious. But that bothers me so much is because they seem to lack a purpose. And a part
merchandising.
Of
merchandising. Yeah, yeah, let me get the sound.
Merchandising.
And well, because it was really bizarre. I watched the Stephen Curry golf kind of parody show, Holy Moly, that was like did three or four seasons in the summer. Like extreme mini golf weirdness, which was fun. But the last season that they did, they tied the Muppets into it by like Steph Curry had to like kidnap Kermit and Miss Piggy was looking for him. And none of it, they were never shown like on the course with the people playing golf. It was always just a subplot that would like do give 2 or 3 minutes to at the beginning and end of the show. And it's like, why are they here? Is this going to tie into something? Is this actually going to like lead to like a Muppets announcement? Are they going to be on the course at the end when the person does the big putt for like the 500 grand they could win or whatever? No, it was just kind of there in the background. So do they need to like renew the IP or something? I don't get it.
I don't know, but that kind of reminds me of a conversation you and I were having on Discord privately, where we were talking about like, I sent you the Seth MacFarlane clip where they were talking about how like, as an animated series goes on, typically a character's voice octave will go a little bit higher. The pitch will get a little bit higher, where he's talking about like, where he's, when he originally started the Family Guy, he's like, Peter's like, hey Lois, how's it going? Now he's like, hey Lois, how's it going? I know it's a horrible Peter Griffin, but like just for effect. And they're talking about how like as you get older, your voice gets deeper, so you're like overcompensating. I feel like the inverse is happening with Kermit, where, you know, Kermit's always been like, hi ho. Now he's like, hi ho. What the hell is wrong with Kermit? Did he get his tonsils removed? Like, his voice has been progressively getting deeper since Jim Henson had died and the role was passed on. But like, you go to Muppet Treasure Island and Kermit still sounds like Kermit. You go to Jason Segel's Muppets, it still sounds like Kermit. But then since Disney like started doing Disney Plus stuff, they cast a new Kermit and his voice is just, it's off-putting how low pitched it is. And like, I don't know what the intention is there, but it really makes me just want to be like, I need to go watch Muppet Christmas Carol. I need to go watch Muppet Treasure Island. whatever else I can get my hands on that has the appropriate Kermit octave.
Available on Disney Plus. Maybe that's the intention.
Maybe. But to also tie it back into Family Guy, one of the clips that lives forever in my head rent-free is, well, now we got wrong-sounding Muppets. Waka Waka, some funny-ass shit. to steer this back towards Fallout.
Well, I mean, this isn't a Fallout center.
Well, I just realized I never gave my rating.
Yeah, you never finished talking
fair.
About it.
I love the way it ended. I'm not going to spoil it because, you know, some people may not be finishing yet. But the mystery, the twists, the freaking horror of the what is at the dining room table. Oh, my God. I'm happy with it. I think that it's like Lucy's actress, Ella Portney.
I forget. I looked it up last time and then immediately Ella
Purnell. There you go. Sorry.
Purnell.
Yeah. Maximus, Aaron Moten, Walton Goggins as the ghoul, Moises Ares as Norm, her brother. They nailed it all. It's fantastic. I'm excited for it. And one of the things I don't think any of us mentioned was this. The composer is Ramin Djawadi, who did Game of Thrones. But the music of the old standards is fucking fantastic.
It's a good soundtrack. Although I will say, I think episodes 3 and 4, or maybe 2 and 3, like one ends with a Johnny Cash song and then the other one starts with a Johnny Cash song.
Yeah.
And I could not tell you if they're the same song or if they just chose, they're like, Folsom Prison Blues is too expensive. But we want Folsom Prison Blues. Johnny Cash has a whole catalog of songs that sound similar enough to Folsom Prison Blues. Yeah. Let's just get two of those for the cost of one.
I'll say, yeah, for my rating is a must see because I loved it.
Yeah. And it's great. And I think it is a really interesting, you know, I think I talked a lot about last time about how I don't really put much stock in like the grander Fallout lore. Like I know it's there. And in certain games, it has wider emphasis than others. But like in general, you're just playing a character that is swept up in things that are not necessarily going to be, you're not necessarily going to be lost if you didn't play Fallout 1, 2, 3, and 4, right? If you're jumping into whatever the newest one is. Anyway.
Yeah, I've never played a Fallout game beyond the tutorials. So I came in and followed this just fine.
Yeah. And that said, I think it does some interesting things to like, sort of not alter Fallout lore, but like there are some certain things about like the nature of the apocalypse that were never confirmed before now. And I think everyone sort of gestured at it being something different before now while it was still being largely unknowable. So there's like different things that it does with like longstanding Fallout tropes that I think are interesting and work really well for this story and also still fit within the wider world. Like, you know, the thing I just mentioned about the nature of the apocalypse, I think fits is a thing that I think could seem a little bit mustache twirly.
Yeah.
To take a phrase, but also fits in some of the like wider things that were already true about those games. And again, if we're being vague about spoilers in the end, that I won't say much more, but it's a really interesting way to reframe certain things about the world in a way that I think makes sense for the larger world and also make a lot of sense for this specific story.
I think they've left enough room for flashbacks because the flashbacks kind of do a hard stop at a certain moment, but we still have the space between that moment and the birthday party that started it to fill in some gaps there. And there's enough unknowns about the two main villains, as it turns out there are two villains, that they can fill in some of that. But I don't think they need it. I don't want to see like seasons 3 and seasons 4 having a flashback every other episode.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see where it's like how I think they're definitely leaving some things to follow up on because there's like at least one notable thing that they do in the flashbacks that has not been answered yet.
Oh yeah,
in terms of like how certain characters relate to the wider thing. But, you know, it's not a thing that I think if they go into like season 4, 5, 6, you know, I don't think they can, I don't think they can tease that out forever.
No,
I think this is a solid 2, maybe 3 season series. And then from there, they've jumped the shark.
Yeah, I can see there maybe 3, maybe lean into 4, but
I guess it would depend on what they're doing, you know, if they're still doing a thing where
they could introduce new characters and kill off other characters. So like you could have a rotating cast.
Yeah. And I mean, if they're still doing the thing where the ghoul sees a cowboy hat and suddenly remembers the time that he also had a cowboy hat in life, you know, that might be,
that's the framing device that's going to get old real fast. If that's,
I was just going to say they have an expiration date, I think. But yes, Walton Goggins rules. So he
also probably is not wanting to sit in that makeup chair for 3-4 years. No, he could Tony Stark it and at one point just wear a green hood and they can CGI the whole thing. But you do lose a little of the luster with CGI.
I will say this. I know that we're trying to wrap up Fallout. There is, again, if we're being against spoilers, there is one thing that happens in the last episode that made me like laugh out loud and not intentionally, and it's the very notable and very, I think, not very good de-aging in a very specific scene.
Oh yeah,
of a character. Like that happened and I knew it was coming, I could see it coming, but as soon as the camera was on him, I was like, oh man, this is such a pivotal moment, and you kind of whiffed it.
Yeah, it was really weird when we got that flashback with Blind Al and young Deadpool. Is just bizarre. Oh, sorry, spoilers, my bad.
So Matt, I know you've got a fairly hard out coming up here in a second. But since it's a what you're doing, I'm gonna jump in here real quick because I've got at least 2 shows that I really want to talk about. The first one being Shogun, very, very good. IGN can fuck off with their whole Shogun's better than Game of Thrones nonsense that they're trying to engagement farm. Shogun is a very different show from Game of Thrones, but also you cannot discredit the popularity of Game of Thrones. There was no one that was not watching that show. Game of Thrones ruled the world for like 10 years and they shit the bed in the final 2 seasons. Those first 7 seasons though, like those are like television masterpieces. You can't discredit that.
Yeah, I agree. Those first 4 seasons are just 4 masterpieces. Once they get to Dorne, man. Once they get to Dorne.
Fair.
All I'll say is this. Stuff like NCIS, Yellowstone, those are like the most watched shows on network television, you know.
That's because retirees have nothing better to do than watch those marathons on syndication.
Yeah, we don't have anything better to do on Sunday nights than watch people.
But like, I'm just saying, like, IGN just pissed me off with that, and I had to get that out there. But Shogun is very good. I can understand the Game of Thrones implications, but there's no mysticism in it. It is just a very straightforward series of mini series. It's 10 episodes. That's all it'll ever be. About late feudal Japan and somewhat political theater that's happening. But because it's feudal Japan, it's samurai fights. And the show just does amazing character work. The sets are amazing. The costume design is amazing. You can watch it, and it was filmed and is intended to be watched as spoken in Japan with Japanese with subtitles. And there's like one English speaking person who is technically speaking Portuguese throughout the show, but because they need that window for English speaking audience members, they present the Portuguese as English, just so that we know what's happening without the entire show being subtitled.
That sounds better than Game of Thrones, honestly.
Am I understanding correctly that you can just, you know, if it's a spoiler, you know, cut this part out, but the ending ties directly into The Last Samurai with Tom Cruise. Is that correct?
Allegedly.
Okay, just checking.
But the other thing I do want to talk about real quick, and then Matt, you can talk about your stuff real quick and we'll head on out. I binged the 6-episode series Knuckles, and dear God, I don't know if I have a bigger regret in 2024, and that includes Madam Web. that show being called Knuckles should be violations for false advertising. They clearly had no budget. They brought in Sonic and Tails for the first episode, and then by the end of the first episode, it's just Knuckles with occasional cameos of other CGI characters that are not Sonic or Tails. And there's, like, speaking of Game of Thrones, there, the Hound is a villain in this. There's a guy who's doing a really big Liam Neeson impression. But this show is like someone wrote a comedy movie that was never going to get greenlit. And so they went, what if we did a CGI sidekick? And Paramount went, we've got Idris Elba on contract for something. We can get him in for a Sonic spinoff. Let's do that. And it's just, it's so bad. And like part of me feels like they know it's bad, which is why they do so many tropes. Like they do a training montage and they do, I'm holding out for a hero, which is, to me, good song can be a good moment when done properly for a training montage. But if you're just throwing it in there to be lazy and be like, it's a training montage, this is what they do. No, you're losing points for me. Like, that's also part of what the Mario movie lost some points for me, because it was so safe and unoriginal in certain aspects. The best part of this show is episode 4, which is weirdly the episode where they very clearly went, we can't CGI character every episode. So you have a budget for 4 minutes to do CGI. The rest of the stuff we just have to do practically. And they went, okay. And they have like this weird, it's not drug induced, but it's a hallucination where Wade, the main character of the show, like, it's called Knuckles, but Wade is the main character. He has a hallucination that is a training montage that's also set to a rock opera. And there's like this giant monster puppet that they bring in for this. And as weird as it is to say, that is the most fun that this show has. And it's actually pretty incredible. You could probably just pop on episode 4, watch it, and be like, okay, that was interesting. Like, it almost feels more like a Tenacious D video.
Interesting.
I have not watched that show because I never got around to watching Sonic 2. But it is really incredible to me that we are like on the cusp of having like our third big budget.
I have no idea how these movies are successful.
Sonic movie, and like, we're doing Sonic, we're doing Tails, we're doing Knuckles, we're doing fucking Shadow the Hedgehog.
Keanu Reeves as Shadow the Hedgehog.
Yeah, it's just like an insane, and maybe it's just, I don't know, if I wanted to be cynical, and sometimes I do, I could talk about how like our culture is, we're in a dead zone of culture where the only things that we have are intellectual property to farm out for various adaptations.
Creative bankruptcy. Yes, I would agree.
But you know, if I want to be more charitable, it's just really honestly incredible that we are getting basically a trilogy of, you know, that first movie was all right for a kids movie. You know, we're getting a trilogy.
That does
of
the
those.
Trope that I talked about that I hate, where it's just like character falls into weird world and now they have to exist in it.
It's called Nisekai, Josh. I thought you were an anime guy now.
I don't know the terms yet. The only one I know is Magical Girl.
All right. First off, the Knuckles show. You did not mention they dragged Stalker Channing and Cary Elwes into that shit.
Oh, yeah. Cary Elwes. Yeah. He plays Bill Murray in Kingpin.
Hmm.
Okay. He plays Bill Murray. Character.
Yeah, he
Bill
plays
Murray.
Bill Murray in Kingpin, except British.
Okay. And second off, I will have you know the power of Sonic the Hedgehog. The first movie did 320 worldwide.
He can really move.
Sonic 2 did 410. It is progressing.
Sonic,
it is slowly getting
attitude.
Better.
People love Sonic. People have always loved Sonic.
It was fun. It was fun and cute and enjoyable because you can tell. Well, you know, they can only do so much with Jim Carrey, okay? they can only CGI him into a Robotnik outfit once or twice. The budgets are low. They don't have it. And frankly, do you really want them to just go full CGI and give us the Super Mario movie?
No, but I also don't want this. But I'm also not a big Sonic fan, so I don't care. But I just think it's... again, creatively bankrupt that this is what they're doing because James Marsden is in it and we have to just follow that CGI character model.
People love Sonic. People yearn for Sonic. That blue hedgehog is... I have outgrown Sonic, but he persists. You know, children, they wake up to Sonic every day.
I have no idea where you're going with this.
I'm just saying, people love him. It's like how your grandpa used to watch Scooby-Doo and we still have fucking Scooby-Doo cartoons around. Sonic,
some of them are really good.
If you say so.
I forget which one. I don't remember. There was one that from the 2010s that was really good. I can't freaking remember. It's Mystery Inc. Maybe. I don't remember. I don't know.
Aren't we also in like the 20th anniversary of Scooby-Doo 1 or 2 from James Gunn? I know internet's getting really up about that, those live action movies hitting anniversaries, even though at the time everyone hated them. But, you know, time is a fickle thing and people are allowed to change their opinions.
Well, and here's the thing that happens is that everyone who was a child when those movies came out and really loved them
fair
is now an adult. And it's like, oh, yeah, I like that movie.
It was actually also announced that Greg Berlanti is going to be adapting a live action Netflix Scooby-Doo series, which Netflix needs to just stop.
Well, that's something I was actually thinking of when you were talking about the Power Rangers thing. And because Scooby-Doo is, I believe, through some very...
It's like, a Warner Brothers property.
Yeah, it's through some ownership like layers. It's Warner Brothers.
Yeah, but I believe it's a Hanna-Barbera cartoon that Warner Brothers owns.
Yeah, which is a weird thing that we're also seeing, similarly to that Power Rangers thing, where like media is just in a weird space, and Warner Brothers is the worst of it, but you see it in other places too, where we all have these streaming services that you would think we would use to like push our properties onto, but that's not happening. Like, you know, Warner Brothers has like a fucking Batman animated series follow-up from Bruce Timm, the guy from Batman the Animated Series. They're not putting on Max. They're licensing out to somebody else, which is like insane to me. Like, you have like, why is Netflix getting this and not Scooby-Doo? You know, Paramount makes a big deal about getting all Star Trek back to their streaming services, and then they're like canceling shows and like licensing them out to Netflix. It's in, like, media is in such a weird place right now.
Yeah, it makes no sense because, like, I remember when Scrubs was on the air mid-2000s into early 2010s, and it was originally produced through, I believe, an NBC affiliate, and then by, like, season 6, ABC bought the rights to it, but they still allowed NBC to air the show. And then when NBC didn't renew it after season 7, ABC's like, okay, we'll put you on our network. But yeah, there's weird caveats in how they can make money through all that.
That happened with Brooklyn Nine-Nine as well, I believe, where I think they were originally on Fox for a long time.
They were canceled on Fox, and then NBC revived it.
For like a season or two. I can't remember if it was for last season or not. But because NBC Universal was producing the show, I guess that's a thing that has kind of always happened to some degree or another in rare cases. But it's weird to me that like now in this place where all of these studios have a specific walled garden where it's like, we're your destination for all of our stuff, the home of DC Comics, the home of Star Trek, whatever. Now we're sort of like there's gaps in the walls now where it's like, oh, well, home of DC Comics, except for like, all this DC stuff, we let
all the good
slip
stuff.
we let slip to Netflix again.
I do wonder if the reason why Netflix is getting a live Scooby-Doo is because of rights issues, where like maybe the cartoons are owned by a specific person, but the live action is licensed to somebody else who struck a deal. Because that was a problem with Star Trek for a long time. Is that Star Trek, the TV series was owned by one arm, but then
the movie rights were different.
I mean, even something as narrow as James Bond, James Bond's rights were tied up with three different people for a long time. You had the Broccoli's with the Ian Productions, who had the rights to all the books except for Casino Royale. And then with Casino Royale being owned by one person, but then also you had specific plot points and characters owned by another person, which is how you got Never Say Never Again. And they were sitting on that. And the person who owned Never Say Never Again owned the rights to like Blofeld, which is when we got Casino Royale, they had bought the rights back to Casino Royale and had all those. But then after that other person gave up the rights to Blofeld, then we got Spectre.
Well, wasn't that also that was still something that was happening when Quantum of Solace happened, because they could not use Spectre at that time. They're like, oh, we're Quantum, which then they later retconned into being a subsect of Spectre. But Matt, I know we're past your out time, but is there any what you doings that you wanted to bring up real quick?
I don't know. I guess there's all kinds of stuff I'm doing. I've been watching The Sopranos, which it turns out is a very good television show, also celebrating its 25th anniversary.
What's The Sopranos?
Oh, well, it's just a show about a guy who, like, you know, he's got troubles and he goes to therapy about it and just the kinds of various things he gets up to, you know?
Is it a prequel to Lucifer then?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Which is also a prequel to Hannibal.
Yeah, the last episode, Lucifer comes up and he's like,
which they might be reviving.
Hell yeah, I hope so.
The guy that Will and Mads Mikkelsen, the guy that played Will and Mads Mikkelsen, who played Hannibal Lecter, they were at C2E2 and they teased that there is a possible revival happening.
Oh, that show. I love that show so much. I could go on and on about Hannibal.
I've not seen all of it, but like that's a show that is insane that it aired on the National Broadcasting Corporation.
True. On Friday nights at 8.
Yeah, watch that show and then think to yourself, oh, that was on NBC, you know.
For 3 years when that...
Where The Office aired. You
know? Yeah. Yeah. For 3 years that show was on, I had to go to a different room and watch it by myself because my wife was like, no, not on the main TV. Not while I'm awake.
You know, maybe this is something for a later What You're Doing, because I'm sure I'll still be playing it. But I think the last What You're Doing, I talked about finishing Final Fantasy VII Remake, and now I'm playing Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, which is the follow-up to that, which is a pretty wild game in a lot of ways, where it's like really channeling like the sort of maximalist throw a bunch of shit at the wall and see what sticks ethos of like the wild west of like PS1 RPG development, where it's just like, I don't know, what about a bunch of mini games, you know, like, oh, here's a, what if we give you a mini game every 10 seconds? And so Rebirth is like weirdly doing that by way, sort of trying to recapture the feeling of that moment in Final Fantasy VII, where you like finish Midgard and get out into the open world, by way of like, it's also kind of just like an open world game with like, oh, there's a map with a bunch of stuff on it, but also a bunch of that stuff is running around the world, like doing weird mini games and stuff. I don't know necessarily. I mean, it's a good game. I don't know. It's a good game. It's a huge game. I don't totally know how I feel about it yet, except that like I'm hooked on it. You know, it's like,
it's pretty.
It's pretty, and it's like very, it's really doing, it's really kind of trying to recontextualize and figure out what, how to translate that sort of classic RPG format in a way that both grows on and sort of like, it grows on what the last couple games in Final Fantasy in general have done, but also is like, doing stuff that I wish those games had done, if that makes sense, where I like Final Fantasy 16 to a certain degree, but it's like a very narrow game with a very narrow focus that I wish had been slightly expanded, even if it wasn't to this degree.
Seems fair. All right, Alex, let everyone know how they can win a copy, how someone will win a Steam copy of Marvel Midnight Suns.
Listen, episode 150 is coming up. That officially means that we have made it to the halfway point of this podcast. And by halfway, I mean the first quarter. And by the first quarter, I mean not even a tenth of the way there. We're in this for a long time. And what you can do to keep us in this, you can submit for a SmackDown. You give us a fight, and you'll be entered into our randomized raffle where one person will win a Steam copy of Marvel's Midnight Suns.
I feel like you better bring the good stuff. Sex Panther. 75% of the time it works every time.
I believe that's Naked Man.
2 out of 3 times.
Give us some suggestions. We need to know, because this time there's no, they're going to be friends. We're going full brutality. This is a fight to the death.
Only if Matt's not involved. But you can also join our Discord, submit submissions there. You can email us at tsmackpod@gmail.com. Link to our Discord is in the episode description. Don't forget to find us on social media at Talking Smack Pod. You can find us on Blue Sky, Instagram, Threads, Hive Social, Post News, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, and Lonnie's website. Thank you to Leo Allen for our musical themes, Beppo for our original avatars, Retro Ale Studios for our Ricky avatar. Alex, who's remixing our themes this week?
Bon Jovi, because I've been watching Thank You, Goodnight, the Hulu Bon Jovi documentary about their 40 years, and it is fantastic.
All right.
Hulu, well, not a sponsor, still, but fucking it's should
about,
be.
It's still about Bon Jovi, though, so I mean, how good can it be?
Don't forget to like, subscribe, rate, review on your podcatcher of choice, and don't forget, all you have to do for a review is let us know if you'd rather listen to the podcast or would you rather watch Madam Web. Thank you, Matt, for being here. Thank you, Alex, for being here. But most importantly, thank you, dear listener, for listening. Please take care, and we will see you next week.
Fuck, I have one more thing.
Yo, what's that?
I've been watching Star Trek.